Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Kaveh Movahed. This is our last episode for 2024, and instead of dropping something heavy on you going into the holidays, we've decided to take a look back at some of our favorite conversations from the year. The KUNM News team brought you 39 episodes of Let's Talk New Mexico in 2024. The discussion topics range broadly from the scarcity of doctors and pharmacies to wildlife management and the state's nuclear waste isolation pilot plant. We talked to state, county, and city officials and folks just like you who are doing work that contributes to our communities. Today, with help from KUNM reporter Taylor Velasquez, who also hosts Let's Talk New Mexico regularly, we'll listen back to some of those folks' discussions, discussing what's important to them and their communities. We appreciate you listening in with us too, but we won't be taking live calls today since there are no live guests. However, if you have a favorite Let's Talk moment, topic, or guest from this year, we invite you to email us during the show, and we'll try to squeeze in your comments between clips because, after all, this show just wouldn't be the same without including the voices of our listeners. With that, let's get going. Thanks for being in the studio with me this morning, Taylor. We've been on the air at the same time. Actually, we've never been on the air at the same time, so this is kind of special. It's a treat.
Yeah, good morning, Kaveh. It is a rarity to be with you in the same room during this show, but I can't believe this is our last show of the year. It's really flown by, but we've pulled together some segments from some of our favorite Let's Talk New Mexico shows of 2024. Most of them are serious, but some of them are fun, but all of them are important to our communities in one way or another. So, Kaveh, what are we going to hear from first?
Well, we're going to start with a show we did in September, not too long after the summer's special legislative session when Governor Lujan Grisham called lawmakers back to Santa Fe to pass several public safety measures. Those special sessions typically only last a few days, though, and a long list of advocates and experts didn't think reworking involuntary commitment and competency to stand trial could be adequately and thoughtfully done under those circumstances. Lawmakers overwhelmingly agreed and adjourned without taking up the public safety measures. The governor then responded with a still ongoing traveling series of town halls all around the state on public safety. I think we can expect this to be among her priorities in the upcoming legislative session. In the clip, you'll hear several guests, starting with the governor's senior public safety advisor, Ben Baker, then Gabby Dietrich, the executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. That's NAMI, New Mexico, followed by State Representative Christine Chandler and Matt Mirarki from Enlace Comunitario. Here's that clip. For broadening definitions to determine who's a danger to oneself or to others. Why is that reform needed, and what kinds of things would you like to include that are not there now?
Sure. I think one of the most important things to think about in this is the perspective of, particularly when we're talking about who's a danger to self and others and what does that mean. There are some legal definitions that define what assessors of those things will determine at the time. And as we mentioned earlier, largely that's police officers. That's what we're talking about, is what does a person take when they're a danger to self or others? In this case, what we could be talking about is what does a family member do with an adult? And this is a phone conversation I've had dozens of times with New Mexicans over the last year, family members. What do I do with a son or daughter, a family member who is an adult, who is suffering from severe mental health disorder exacerbated by substance abuse disorder or not, who is unwilling to seek treatment, who is unwilling to continue to take the medication that will take the edge off of their treatment, that is unable to get to these things done voluntarily. And willingness, you know, having worked with substance abuse addicted folks for my entire adult life, willingness is a thing that is generally internally generated. And I believe when we're talking about substance abuse disorder, the thing that folks have to deal with is what happens when a person's condition is making them unable to make those decisions that are in the best interest of keeping them fed, nourished, out of, let's say, harm's way from running across the street, creating an environment where it's unsafe for themselves. And then, as we've seen in many tragic incidences, and I think this is an important kind of fact and historical reference for us to put out there, you have a parent who is at their wit's end, who is trying to get help for their family member, they call the police and there is a deadly encounter with law enforcement personnel. That is an outcome that no one is seeking. That is an outcome that no one wants. And again, the goal here is to expand who the folks can be making those assessments, what those should be in terms of broadening the parameters so that they include things like self-nourishment, for example. Are you keeping yourself fed and healthy? And then more particularly, how to get those folks into a place where they have an opportunity to recover.
Gabby, you said NAMI typically supports voluntary treatment, but Ben had pointed to sometimes involuntary treatment. Did the plan seem reasonable to you?
So one of the main features of serious mental illness is a symptom called anosognosia. And anosognosia means that a person is unable to know that they are experiencing mental illness. So it's not the question of willingness is extremely complicated, because if you did not know that you had a mental health condition and you just thought a lot of scary things were happening, you would be resistant to treatment too, in the same way that if you were not a diabetic and I told you I wanted to put some insulin in your arm, you'd yank your arm away and tell me to get lost. It's not that these folks are irrational. It's that they are experiencing a separate reality. And anosognosia is not a choice. It's not denial. It's a condition that is related to what happens to people's brains when they have severe mental illness. And so absolutely, there are situations when involuntary treatment is necessary. I agree that that is true. But it is a last resort. The number one way of getting a person with that condition to accept treatment is to build trust with someone in their lives who they grow enough respect for, they grow enough trust in, that they're willing to accept treatment even if they themselves don't actually believe they need it. The compassion piece here around willingness versus anosognosia, that's a really important piece of information that people need to know.
Now, a lot of people don't have friends or family who they can build that kind of trust with, who are in a position to try to get them help. Can that trust be built with law enforcement or judges or court-imposed doctors?
It's a long-term relationship kind of a thing. So you're not going to walk into somebody's house and 15 minutes later have that kind of relationship with them. It's something that needs to take place over the long haul. And so that's why relationships with providers and such are so important.
Okay. Ben, would you like to add something?
Excellent. Thank you very much, Gabby, for that. I think that's important because I certainly don't want to intimate that a person lacks the willingness to achieve this, and I think you're exactly right. I want to share an experience I had in Carlsbad last month. We've traveled the state speaking with constituents in the thousands at this point, and a woman who's a business owner in Carlsbad stood up during her opportunity to speak and shared with me and the community members there her experience in dealing with a severe substance abuse disorder family member. And they didn't identify them further than that, except that they had been to every clinical place within the state of New Mexico. They had paid for every out-of-state opportunity within the southwestern area of the United States, and that she took her daughter to northern Mexico, to the town where she was born and raised since becoming a naturalized citizen, where they do require and mandate folks to stay in treatment facilities, because what she described over and over again was she would go in for the prescribed number of days, she would come out and instantaneously relapse, and she was watching her family member die in front of her as she described it. And this was really compelling to me because I've seen these things on the reception end also, but not within my own family. But one of the things that's important is that we had a New Mexico constituent travel to another country to receive treatment that is being, you know, proffered for debate on how to do this best to get folks into the place where they need care.
And I will remind listeners that not so many months ago, my colleague Nash Jones hosted an episode of this show revisiting the state's behavioral healthcare system 10 years after the big shakeup under former Governor Susana Martinez. You can find that online at KUNM.org. Representative Chandler, you wanted to respond?
Yes, thank you very much. I think Ben hit on a very good point here. We in the state do not have adequate treatment facilities. And if a person has to leave the state and go to Mexico to get the treatment that they need, I think that's a very telling and condemning point for our state. And what I believe, and I think many here, I mean, everyone here would agree, is we need better access to better behavioral health and drug treatment. And we need facilities built across the state. I hear this commonly among my constituents and from other citizens in the state. We do not have enough treatment facilities. We do not have enough support. And if we're sincere in our effort to want to address the mental health issue and the growing substance abuse issue, that is what we should be focused on, and not on other law enforcement initiatives that I think will not address the underlying root causes that is key to eventually being able to get our arms around this very significant issue in the state.
I'd like to add one more voice to the conversation now. We have Matt Mirarki in the studio. Matt is the Director of Advancement and Operations for Enlace Comunitario. For 25 years, Enlace Comunitario has worked in central New Mexico to help Latina immigrants who are surviving domestic violence. And Matt, you wanted to jump in.
Yes, thank you, Kaveh. Really appreciate the rich discussion. And one thing I wanted to add to this, just to echo some of the points that have been made, is the importance of bringing culturally specific providers at the grassroots level who have been working at the grassroots level, like Enlace, into the conversation around these policies and around this development. Because even though it may seem unrelated, domestic violence has a thematic thread touching on all of the issues that we've mentioned today in terms of mental health support, in terms of quote-unquote competency, because in many situations, abusive partners will question the competency of the victim who has called either law enforcement or has called for assistance, and their competency has been questioned because there's a linguistic gap where the abuser may speak English and can speak English with law enforcement, but law enforcement can't provide linguistically appropriate services for the victim. And so that's where this competency can be easily weaponized against domestic violence survivors in those very contentious situations. And the same goes for especially access to mental health services. As Representative Chandler just mentioned, it is incredibly important to be able to align folks who are experiencing mental health crises, especially culturally appropriate care when necessary. We do have a very culturally specific lens.
That was Ben Baker, Gabby Dietrich, Christine Chandler, and Matt Mirarki, and it was such a good conversation. And surprisingly, even in the wake of the political rift between the governor and lawmakers, we heard a lot of agreement in the room. We talked about mental illness for almost the first half of the hour. Then there was some discussion on guns, too. You can find it all online at KUNM.org. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Kaveh Movahed with Taylor Velasquez. We're revisiting some standout discussions from 2024. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Stay there.
UNM Hospital's 70 years of service includes a Level 1 trauma center, a dedicated children's hospital, and over 150 medical specialties. UNM Health, proud to serve New Mexico and proud to support KUNM. If you're getting a new car this holiday season, consider giving the old one to KUNM as a gift. Tis the season. You'll get a KUNM membership just in time for those holiday celebrations. Donated cars and trucks are a big reason we've been able to bring you all the news and music programming you enjoy. Your vehicle donation makes a real difference in our community. So donate your vehicle today at KUNM.org or call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Kaveh Movahed in the studio with Taylor Velasquez. Today, we're listening back to some favorite shows from the year. If you'd like to highlight a memorable topic or guest from 2024, tell us by emailing letstalk@kunm.org. Taylor, for months, the KUNM team, following politics can be exciting because it touches every aspect of life. Tell us about a political discussion you'd like to highlight.
For sure. I think for months, the KUNM news team really brought together stories on issues candidates were talking about both locally and nationally. We started with the primaries, and then we followed all the way through to the general elections this year. Bryce Dix, who everyone's familiar with, mm-hmm. with hosting Morning Edition, brought us a show that detailed how climate change was impacting the way folks were voting in this election and discussed the real-life conditions that many New Mexicans have endured for the last few years when it comes to wildfires, drought, and extreme heat. Mm-hmm. So in this next clip, we'll hear from Demise Foster, the CEO of Conservation Voters for New Mexico, a nonprofit that helps voters stay up to date on all things climate change and policy. And we'll also hear from Michael Rocha, Associate Political Science Professor at the University of New Mexico. Here's some of that conversation.
You can go and check out every single bill they voted on, how they voted, and what's in that bill for each legislative agenda, and then also their lifetime scores calculated with all their scores, and then you get an average.
Fascinating. This scorecard has been around for a while, like around 19 years, I think, give or take, correct? So what trends in climate voting records jump out at you at the get-go?
Well, it's interesting, and, you know, for particularly the last, I would say, 10 years, we've seen the scores get much more at each extreme. We end up having a lot more 100 percenters and a lot more zeros. You know, when we first started doing the scorecard, we really didn't get a lot of zeros, meaning, I mean, you have to work really hard not to cast one good vote on environment. It's hard. We gave Susana Martinez an F during those 8 years that she was in office because she didn't move anything around climate after Governor Bill Richardson started to build up some really great policy wins on the environment and climate. So, yeah, it's hard. So the trends we've noticed is it's getting much more harder to bring any good votes in. We do occasionally have some success with bringing in more Republicans to vote on clean energy. And that's always great to see. Mm-hmm. But, you know, since Trump took office, we're seeing increase when he did take office. We've seen a lot more division in how people vote. And I think, you know, there's a lot of pressure in the legislature, too, to, you know, continue to support the oil and gas industry, to prop that up at any length. And, you know, it's interesting, and this may not be the part of the segment you want to jump into this, but, you know, 53% of our state's emissions come from the oil and gas industry.
Yeah.
And we have made enormous, significant progress on climate policy since 2019 when Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham took office. She came out of the 2018 election and just did an executive order on climate, passed the Energy Transition Act, the biggest, boldest climate policy ever passed in the country and in New Mexico. Here we are, you know, fast forward to where we are today, and we're behind on climate. What we see is there's a tremendous amount of pressure from the oil and gas industry and in the Capitol during the session and year round at interim committee to continue to give that industry more support.
Yeah.
And I think it's time we stop propping up the oil and gas industry and embrace all these amazing resources we have around wind and solar. We have just such an abundant, more affordable way to get to zero emissions target that the governor set for us in her executive order.
Right. And let me cut you off really quick. We could talk policy a little bit later on in the show. I did want to go back to your scorecard because you kind of mentioned these 100 percenters, right? Which you all label as climate champions, right? I kind of wanted to ask, what makes a climate champion other than being 100%? Because I saw some folks on that scorecard who had lower scores who you labeled as climate champions, right?
There may be one year in particular that someone really steps up and gets 100%. Sometimes it takes years to educate the legislatures on climate policy.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to catch up. So sometimes they're not sure. They're just trying to get their bearings. We, by the way, have a lot of newer legislators. A lot of the...
From the midterms, correct?
Oh, yeah. A lot of them stepped down. And I don't see this much now. What we're seeing from the newer legislators now, the trend is they come in ready to vote. They want to vote on good climate policy. But they get into a culture that maybe is not quite there yet with them. So, you know, I would say, you know, 8 years ago, people would come in and, as I said, they knew very little about climate policy, maybe were a little reticent. So now we see their scores going up, and that is a trend. We see them getting higher and higher. And, you know, you don't have 100% to be a champion. You need like a 90 and above to be a champion. We realize things come up in terms of absences can affect someone's score.
Let me, I think this is a great place to rope in another one of our guests who is in studio. Michael Rocca is a associate professor of political science at the University of New Mexico. And I just wanted to give full disclosure here. He is the director of my Master of Public Policy program. I'm not getting any extra credit here. So thank you so much for being here, Mike.
My
really
pleasure,
appreciate
Bryce.
It. You've been hearing Demise talk a little bit about partisan voting trends, right? Especially here in the state. Why do big ticket items like abortion, immigration, and in this case, you know, climate change tend to be so divisive?
That's a great question. And my ears perked up when I heard Demise mention the 0 to 100 scale, the polarization.
Yeah.
That is absolutely consistent with what's been happening in the United States Congress at the federal level for the last 20 or 30 years. And that polarization is, in fact, finding its way in these big ticket items into state legislatures now. Now that local and state elections are becoming more polarized, we're kind of feeling a feeling for that right now in New Mexico with President Trump coming into the state today. And that feeling that we're all getting is absolutely empirically true, where these issues that you're talking about, abortion, climate change, it could be education, immigration, the ones that we're most used to hearing at a polarized level at the federal level in the national legislature, it's finding the exact same trends now in the state legislature. And it's because politics all across America is becoming more national. It's becoming more nationalized, meaning what happens in the local and the state is becoming much more closely aligned with what's happening in national politics now more than ever. And there's a lot of other factors that go into polarization, like sorting, geographic and partisan sorting, which we can get into in a little bit. But this, the 0 to 100 scorecard absolutely is becoming a trend in state legislatures for the last 10 to 15 years. So what Denise was mentioning just anecdotally in this one issue in the last couple years on climate change absolutely is true for all issues.
And that was Morning Edition host Bryce Dix bringing you a Let's Talk New Mexico episode all about how climate change has been impacting voters and their decisions when they cast their ballots. I think this show sets up our coverage well for 2025.
Yes.
Next January, we'll see many changes in politics, both locally and nationally. We'll see many new faces in our legislative session that begins on January 21st. And we'll see how that scorecard will really change after the 60-day legislative session. Also, we'll see Donald Trump retake the presidential office the day before. Mm. So we'll have to see how he makes good on his promises to get rid of all of the Biden administration regulations that would cut things like carbon emissions and usher the country away from fossil fuels.
Yeah, thanks, Taylor. Sometimes it really does feel like doom and gloom in the news business. But I think the best way forward is to address the hard topics head on. That's something we do on Let's Talk New Mexico. One of the harder conversations we had this last year was over aging and long-term care. It was hosted by our news director, Megan Kamrick, and I produced and directed the show. And that one was particularly tough for me because my mother had died in a care facility just a month before. And it really almost felt like I was listening to my own family's story. Let's hear some of that discussion, starting with Kevin Robinson Avila talking about finding help for his mother and brother, then Adrian Smith of the New Mexico Caregivers Coalition, and finally journalist Jordan Rao from KFF Health News. Here's the clip.
The real bad experience we had was the nursing homes themselves. Once they get bought out by these big multinational corporations, the care goes plummeting downhill.
What kind of issues did you encounter when that happened?
Well, I'll give one example. I won't name names of the nursing facilities, but she was in one that had an excellent reputation. That's why we put her there, moving her out of one that the situation had just happened and went downhill. We put her in there. She was really well cared for. There were lots of staff always there to take care. She roomed with two other women in that facility, always did. But the care was always there. People attentive, nurses attentive. When she needed something, they would be there, take good care of her in terms of the medication. She had a lot of medication she had to take. And then once the ownership changed hands, I don't know how many of the nurses left. I don't have the numbers, but I can tell you there were a fraction of the staff that was there previously were no longer there. That is, a fraction remained. And so she'd sit around for hours trying to get care of things that she needed help with. She's in a wheelchair, confined full time. They constantly got her medications wrong in some cases, and some pretty serious medications in some cases created serious health problems for her. At one point, the only way she could get around, she was in an electric wheelchair. She would go down the hallway, and they decided she's going too fast and being a danger to everybody. They just decided the best way to deal with that, easier for them, take her wheelchair away, and left her lying in her bed, basically bedridden, for a number of days until finally she got a hold of me, and I went in there screaming until they gave her a wheelchair back. I'm just giving you a couple simple examples. There are much more serious things, but the entire care process was just, it just became a disaster. She couldn't get anything. We got her out of there into another one, same process, and finally got into the final nursing home.
Which was a nonprofit, I might add, right? A private
nonprofit. Mm-hmm. That's correct. The multinational companies, rather national level and multinational corporations that have been buying up these healthcare facilities across the board, it's all about squeezing the most profit. Horrendous experience with my brother, who actually died in their care, and we sued the corporation. But that is the biggest and most difficult situation that I had to deal with, how little care they provide once these big for-profit corporations take over.
I spoke with Adrienne Smith from the New Mexico Caregivers Coalition about this. She couldn't come on live, but we have a clip of her talking about this.
This issue that is not sexy until it hits home, and now it's hitting home for everyone. When our demographics changed to now be number fourth in the country, ranked percentage of people 65 and older, and then once COVID was over and we didn't give raises to caregivers during COVID, we're reaping what we sowed when we didn't pay attention to these workers. And I don't know a single agency that's having an easy time finding workers.
When we say caregivers, who are we talking about?
Everybody knows one, but the occupational classification is called a nursing assistant, a home health aide, personal care assistant. We have in New Mexico this term we call homemaker. It's an ancient, kind of pretty outdated term. If a person is a caregiver to people with developmental disabilities, they're called direct support professionals. You know, by and large, there would be about 62,000 in this state who work in that capacity in some way, supporting a person who's elderly and or someone with disability. The 62,000 I mentioned would be those who are in the workforce doing this for a job. There are another 419,000 in the state of New Mexico, according to our AARP office, that do it with or without pay.
Now, I know you did a listening session this past year in 2023. What were the biggest concerns that caregivers had?
Sadly, it makes me think we haven't really done that much, because a lot of what they said in 2023 are the same issues they raised in 2009. The pay is never enough. A lot of them don't even get the employment supports that other employees receive, you know, for a variety of reasons. If they're only able to work 30 hours a week, then those are the people who are having to cobble together two jobs, maybe three, just to make ends meet. There were numerous caregivers I'm thinking of in particular in Farmington, for whatever reason, they mentioned it time and again. You know, this is a 24/7 hour job, but the state will only pay me for 4 hours a day, in a couple of cases, 8 hours a week.
That was Adrienne Smith with the New Mexico Caregivers Coalition. Jordan Rao, how do workforce pay and staffing shortages factor into the challenges finding good, affordable long-term care?
Before I say that, I neglected to say that the vast majority of care is actually unpaid care by families and relatives. And that's, you know, that's, and they've sort of stepped up because of the
and sacrificed
lack of
a lot in their own lives to do that.
Oh, yeah. Huge amounts. But so the workforce, there's a huge workforce shortage of nursing assistants and nurses. And it's a couple of things. There are a lot of people who were burned out from the pandemic. It is exhausting work. The pay is at the bottom of, you know, minimum wage or higher often. It's at the bottom of the healthcare world. And you can make more money in, you know, working at Target or working in a hospital, which is probably a better professional environment to be in than you can working as an aide in a nursing home. There's often not, you know, a career ladder for people. A lot of these people have been traditionally immigrants who've come to the country, and obviously that's a super third rail right now. So those positions aren't being replenished in the same way. So it's a brutal, brutal job. I mean, and there's some very, very dedicated people. There's some people who are very disgruntled who do it and just do it because they have to. There's enormous turnover. You know, a lot of nursing homes have staff turnover, 50% in a year. And so you do have this huge lack of support for these jobs.
That was KUNM's Megan Kamrick with Kevin Robinson Avila, Adrian Smith, and Jordan Rao talking about the struggling long-term care system we have in New Mexico and the United States. While I don't think we're close to solving the problems of an underfunded and understaffed healthcare system, I'm glad we've been able to talk about it several times this year on Let's Talk New Mexico. Taylor, you've hosted the show quite a few times this year. Tell us a little bit about the topics you choose and why.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more that when we come on air, we just want to discuss more of these problems, but it's never with the intent to solve these problems, but bringing in awareness to the healthcare worker shortage. Or we heard an earlier show about public safety, and I think we did bring back Matt from Enlace.
Matt Meraki, yeah.
Yeah, to talk a little bit more about domestic violence. I mean, in New Mexico, we rank slightly higher than the national average. So when we heard that, it really perked our ears, and we said that's a great coverage area that we haven't really been able to dig deeper into. So bringing him back really was helpful for us to expand coverage and dig deeper into issues that really impact a lot of New Mexicans.
And that's something we do from time to time. Generally, we try to get a variety of voices, but once in a while, we get somebody who's just an expert, like Matt Meraki, and we invite them to come back for a second discussion on like an adjacent topic.
Definitely. And that whole panel, if we listen back to the domestic violence show, which is on the Let's Talk New Mexico page for KUNM.org, we heard so many of these experts kind of make this huge topic of domestic violence a little smaller. We heard how diversity really impacts the topic. Mm-hmm. I think we heard Matt earlier talk about law enforcement and linguistic care and how we're not able to provide everyone that linguistic service. So bringing awareness to those issues and maybe having a solution further down the line in our reporting is what matters to us.
Right. I think he went as far as to say that the language barrier is often weaponized by abusers. So, wow.
Definitely. And I think these shows, you know, they inform us every single day of our coverage. Where are we missing out? Whose voices aren't being heard on the radio? And that's why I think this hour every week really matters to me and the KUNM news team.
Okay. Well, you are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Kaveh Movahed, and that's Taylor Velasquez. Stay right there. We'll be back in just a minute.
Support comes from the Western Environmental Law Center, committed to protecting New Mexico's public lands, including Greater Chaco, the climate, and partnering with frontline communities in the Land of Enchantment. Info at westernlaw.org.
Support comes from the Vortex Theater, performing Rudolfo Anaya's holiday classic, The Farolitos of Christmas, filled with traditional music from the holiday season, November 22nd to December 22nd. Information at vortexabq.org.
This week on This American Life, in Lily's family, there's a story everybody knows by heart.
How many times do you think you've heard this story?
50, 100, many times.
If this story had never happened,
all of us wouldn't be here right now.
Sammy wouldn't be here.
Tina wouldn't be here. Marion wouldn't be here. Wally wouldn't be here.
Anyone that we know wouldn't be here.
So what happens when Lily's mom tells her the story is not true?
Sundays at 4 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm Kaveh Movahed with reporter and host Taylor Velasquez. We're not taking calls today as we listen back to standout discussions from 2024, but you can email us if you'd like to point to a guest or topic you enjoyed or thought particularly important. Reach us at letstalk@kunm.org. And Taylor, we did get an email from Frank. Frank says, as a car nut, a mechanical engineer, and a member of the Society of Automotive Engineers, I thought your program on EVs was very well done. Well, thank you, Frank. It presented a good, balanced view of the topic. Well, we appreciate that. We always try to do that. That's our goal, to bring in perspectives that don't always agree, but to kind of talk it out. Well, where are we going next, Taylor?
Yeah, I think as one of the poverty and public health reporters here at KUNM, I've covered many issues. And so far in that realm of public health, I've learned that many of these issues are all interconnected and relate back to one another. So one of my big focus areas this year was actually the healthcare professional worker shortage. I think waiting for months for healthcare appointments are something that we all can relate to.
Yes.
Because of that lacking workforce. And I hosted a show this year talking about the creative solutions that nonprofits and state agencies are considering to improve healthcare access and build out maybe education systems that support people to seek a career in medicine. So in this next conversation, we'll hear from Stephanie Rodriguez. She is the secretary of the New Mexico Higher Education Department. And we'll also hear from Mike May and Hema Gonzalez. They're from Future Focus Education. And one of their interns, Sesha Gonzalez, and here's that clip.
We actually passed a landmark policy, which was the Opportunity Scholarship. We recognize at a state that we had the Lottery Scholarship, which was for recent high school graduates. But a lot of times, older adults, by the way, the average age of a college student is 26 years old, not 18. Older adults are looking to upskill, reskill, or finish that degree that they didn't have the opportunity to finish. It's been a huge success in the state of New Mexico. We have the most inclusive and comprehensive free college program in the nation. The White House even called it the Gold Star example of the country. And it's really encouraging people to go back into the workforce. Now, what have we seen with the Opportunity Scholarship? A lot of times folks are working their day-to-day job, but are realizing that there are high-demand, higher-pay jobs in other sectors. And people are looking to health professions because they pay higher, and they can do that with a short-term credential. We do cover credit-bearing certificates. They can do that with an associate degree, or they can finish up their bachelor's degree. That has been really helping. We've increased enrollment since the implementation of the program by over 7% in the state after a decade of declines. That's one of the initiatives that we put forward.
And I actually want to introduce my next guest who's sitting with me in the studio here this hour, Mike May, Director of Workforce Learning for Future Focus Education, a national organization that started in Albuquerque, and it's working to expand hands-on training and learning in communities in need. And we also have Sesha Gonzalez, who is taking part in their X3 internship program. Good morning, you two. Thanks for coming on the show.
Good morning, Taylor. Great to be here with you.
Mike, just to talk about the creative solution so far this morning when it comes to the healthcare worker shortage, can you tell us a little bit more about Future Focus and how it works with young people while they're still in high school?
Future Focused Education started the X3 internship program back in 2017. It stands for Explore, Experience, and Expand. And it really was designed to provide young people from underrepresented communities with access to professional mentorship and professional workplaces. Like you said, we started that off in high school and now have actually expanded it into an alumni program as well. And the idea is that by offering young people professional mentorship and exposure to real work settings and tasks during high school, by continuing that relationship after high school, you're kind of bridging what otherwise is often a challenging space for young people when they finish high school and supports fall away and maybe some of their plans don't follow through, life intervenes. So we're seeing a lot of success now with really creating what we like to call a runway into, as you mentioned previously with the secretary, growing your own here locally. And healthcare is one of our biggest sectors in our work-based learning internships.
And Sesha, you know, Mike just talked about the success of the program and you're going through it. So can you tell us a little bit more about the X3 internship program, how you got involved? What was that kind of process for you?
I started in high school as well. I started a summer where I was offered a position as a medical assistant at a clinic for UNM. And so I started there. I started that summer. I wasn't really looking to go into healthcare, but my mind changed very quickly working there. And then I graduated high school and I was given the opportunity through Next to continue interning as a college student, which gave me the possibility to be a college student because I had some income. So I was able to support myself through my first semester in college. And now I'm going back for my second semester, hoping to intern again. It really made a difference in my ability to go to college.
And we actually spoke a few months ago, and you can find that news story linked on the webpage for the show, but you had mentioned to me that healthcare wasn't something that was on your radar, but now, like you said, you're pursuing nursing because of your early exposure in high school. So do you think X3 could be an integral tool in addressing the workforce shortage?
I think so, yes. If I had never been exposed to a healthcare setting, I don't think I would have changed my mind to go into healthcare, but it really does expand the horizon that there's a lot more that you can do. And as a Latina and first gen, it allowed me to see that it is possible for me, for people that look like me, who speak like me, to be in the healthcare setting. So I think having these opportunities, these programs, really help us expand our horizons and see what we're truly capable of.
And you're sitting in classrooms with other kids and other people trying to make their way in the world, try to figure out what's next. So do you know other students who came to healthcare because of Future Focus like you?
My best friend, actually, she decided to pursue medical assisting after interning as a medical assistant. And so she went into Carrington and she did her school. She's currently practicing as a medical assistant. It wasn't her first thought. It wasn't what she initially wanted to go to school for, but the intern really woke up like a desire to help people in our community, similar to my case.
And I actually want to introduce another guest from Future Focus this morning, Hema Gonzalez, who is the work-based learning coordinator. Good morning, Hema.
Good morning, Taylor. Thank you for having me on.
We have talked to Mike so far and Cecia about what the program is, but does the program work with other community organizations, like other connections, schools, people like that, to get kids into these professions and to steer them into pursuing something like this?
Part of my role and part of what the organization focuses on is building partnerships with different schools across Albuquerque, but also across the state. Another part of my role is building partnerships and relationships with employers who see the benefit of having young people intern at their placements. And when we talk to the schools and we build the relationships, we see that there is a huge motivation for teachers to introduce students to programs like these. We know that hands-on experiences really help a young person, you know, have a better idea of what it is that they hope to aspire to after finishing high school. And teachers are motivated to be that support system for young people to find those resources outside of the classroom. One thing that we really want to focus on is saying, you know, we really want to make sure that we're focusing on local talent. We know that young people who are in Albuquerque, who are in New Mexico, come from many, many different backgrounds, and they bring many different skill sets that are unique to our state. And so let's invest in them. Let's invest in their talent and their knowledge and their intelligence, too, because they are also deserve to hear that they are just as talented as any other young person across the nation.
The guests in the show all talked about many of the barriers that students are facing when it comes to the expense of college, maybe even the lack of exposure to careers early on in school, and the need to increase funding for higher education institutions. And we've seen the legislature in the interim sessions already discussing this topic with a lot of urgency to reverse the shortage, as even the Legislative Finance Committee reported that without any creative intervention, the solutions that the state will, or without any creative interventions and solutions, the state will actually see a shortage of 5,000 workers. But because of those numbers, I've seen the shortage impact many of my other coverage areas, like the child welfare system, for example. We're seeing CYFD and other agencies call for doctor's appointments, and they're, like us, not getting those appointments within the appropriate time or not getting those appointments at all. So I'm looking forward to bringing listeners more coverage and what outcomes come from even the upcoming legislative session.
Well, remember how I said it's not all doom and gloom in the news business? It's especially true with Let's Talk New Mexico, because we are able to take time to talk about things that are going well in our state, too. And occasionally we do just a show that's for the sake of fun. And those discussions are also important for our communities. For instance, this year we spent 3 weeks talking about the thriving arts in our state. It all started with a conversation we did on money, or the arts economy. In our next audio clip, we'll hear from Taos sculptor and gallery owner Michael Gorman, then mixed media artist Tasha Nez from Gallup, and finally Rose Eason, who runs the nonprofit Gallup Arts. And this time, we'll start with a caller, because our listeners are important to our rich discussions. Here it is.
We do have a caller. Let's go ahead and take Stephen from Santa Fe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I was just going to suggest, from the economic standpoint, I'm a consultant. I'm an art dealer, and I'm taking Santa Fe art to the Austin area. And primarily, I specialize in Pueblo art. I'm 25% Pueblo Indian myself. The demand for over there is quite high. I can maximize the value for my fellow Indigenous artists over there. I just thought I'd let Indigenous artists know that that might be a possibility to take the art to the other states rather than waiting for other states to come visit as tourists, you know?
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling, Stephen. Maybe Michael Gorman, have you tried selling wares out of the area, out of state?
Yes, and that's actually kind of a new part of the model for me, because I mean, having a brick and mortar, I think, brings a lot of legitimacy to the website, to the social media. You know, I think there's, you know, like there's other galleries, you know, there's getting enough work out there that I can show at other galleries and taking it to those places. The advantage I find with going to events is that you have people coming to that event with the intention of purchasing or with the intention of seeing those arts. The disadvantage is it costs money to do all of those. When I did the herd this past March, it cost me about $1,200 in travel, lunches, Airbnbs, all of that, plus the entry fees to go into there. And so if you don't make your sales, you don't make that money back. So, and then the one down in Santa Fe this weekend was actually significantly more expensive, although I'm getting sponsored for that one from an artist friend of mine, Talak Ayalel, who's a cut paper artist that I show in the gallery. He purchased the booth for that and invited me to show along with him. So, you know, it's double-edged sword.
I'm going to take this opportunity to introduce our last two guests on the panel this morning. On Zoom from Gallup, we have Rose Eason, the executive director of Gallup Arts, and we have mixed media artist Tasha Nez. Tasha, how much does your heritage influence your art?
I think it influences it very much. I didn't grow up in a traditional home, like learning traditional practices or anything like that. So when I'm making my artwork and I'm creating things that I love, there's always that reflective part of me who's, you know, looking back on what these cultural, like what my cultural heritage is. And I think that's, you know, making that connection through my art is one of the most valuable things for me as an artist. So yeah, I'm very inspired by that.
For listeners who, you know, don't see it, can you kind of describe it, what it looks like?
A lot of my works are on paper, but I do a lot of paintings also. I would describe my work as more, it's a little abstract and more contemporary. I use a lot of like shapes and colors. I do a lot of mixed media, so I'll add in like, you know, my printmaking process with, you know, just drawing or painting, or my, I'll add in some of my photography. So there's like paper collage. It's a different kind of work for, you know, the area that I live in. And people have said that to me, but I take that as a, you know, a really big compliment.
I know you do a lot of sales just around your area, around home, around Gallup. Caller Steven suggested traveling to other markets to make more money. Is that something you've tried?
Right now, I've been a full-time artist for about a year, so I'm just like beginning to, you know, learn the ropes when it comes to art markets and things. And, you know, to get through the month, we do a lot of like shows and art markets around my hometown. But I've met a lot of artists who have, you know, they have that idea that they have to leave to go to like Indian market and stuff to, you know, make money, which is, you know, something we haven't quite tried yet, but we'll be in Swaya for the first time this year. So we'll see how that goes and what my opinion is of that when it happens.
And Swaya is the Indian market in Santa Fe. It's in August.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that a little bit later. Rose Eason from Gallup Arts. I've heard Gallup called the center of the Indian art world. Why today do we differentiate Native art from other art?
Ooh, that's a big question.
You have 1 minute.
I think, I would defer to the Native artists to kind of tackle that ball of worms. But yes, Gallup has a very, very significant population of artists and Native artists. The estimate is that one in four of our county residents essentially at least makes part of their living through the arts. So it's our community's largest mm-hmm. cottage industry. And to this question of other states' arts markets and the Native arts market circuit in general, I think from Gallup Arts' perspective, it's actually an issue of economic justice because we have so many artists living and working in our community, but they can't make a living in our community. And Gallup's art market is, has a long, well-documented history of being extractive and exploitative. And that's something that we're working to counteract through our nonprofit and our support and direct services to local artists. But I would love nothing more than to see more of our artists be able to live and work from home here and, you know, actually have a thriving family life and not have to defer to outside opportunities as much.
Well, Rose, the markets available to Native artists in Gallup are limited. I think you said there might be 50 trading posts in town, but then you mentioned that history of exploitation going back generations. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so Gallup's art market is still very heavily mediated by the traders, and historically they have been the ones actually maybe in some sense to your first question, deciding what qualifies as Native art and then introducing that to the market and selling it. I mean, in very simple terms, you know, artists sell to traders at, a small percentage of retail value, and traders mark up those prices and kind of reap the benefits of those sales to especially the tourist market. Yes, we have an estimated like 50 something trading posts in town and maybe one Native owned outlet at this point that buys and sells Native art. In addition, Gallup Arts has two downtown art galleries, but we're not modeled in that same commercial way. It's a systemically rooted issue, and it's a hard one for an artist to navigate. And all of us are working together to carve out different pathways and avenues for sales.
That was Michael Gorman, Tasha Nez, and Rose Eason talking about the challenges of being professional Native artists. It was a great discussion that included public art in our cities and how we can support creative industries more generally. You can hear that show in its entirety, along with all of those we've spotlighted today, on our website, kunm.org. There's a drop-down menu under the News tab for Let's Talk New Mexico, and a page for today's show. It's right on our homepage, and it has all the appropriate links to the shows we've heard today. Taylor, do you have any favorite shows that you would like to highlight for us from the year?
Yeah, I have a few, actually. The James Beard Show was a really cool and light show for our listeners and for even myself. I'm a foodie, so hearing what's going on in our state in terms of food, hearing from restaurants that I might have been in was kind of a cool experience to get like a backstage kind of look. But we also did a show last week on animal shelters and rescues. And as a dog owner, I have four little puppies at home. I care deeply about the subject.
Yeah, I also have a dog at home, and that was a really good show. We've done so many really good ones. We had one early in the year on traffic safety, dangerous driving, where we had Dan Mayfield from the city of Albuquerque and the Bernalillo County Undersheriff on. That one was memorable to me because I think they were both really kind of struggling with reconciling that the public wants more from them, and they both felt like they were doing the best they could with the resources they had. And I remember one thing the undersheriff said was, everybody wants everyone else to slow down and stop running red lights, but nobody wants to slow down themselves. I love the opportunity to get into those deeper discussions like that.
Those panels are just integral of the conversations we're having. I think we get different perspectives all throughout the year.
It's true. All right. Well, thank you to the audience for joining us for Let's Talk New Mexico. We will continue into the new year. There's our theme music. We are about out of time. Thanks to everyone who joined the show this year, whether you're in the studio, on Zoom or telephone, or a listener who called or emailed us. You all help make the conversations more robust and inclusive, and we appreciate you. Audio from today's show will be up on our website soon. You can also get the Let's Talk New Mexico podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We'll break for the holidays and return with a new conversation for you on January 9th. You can comment on this show by email at letstalk@kunm.org or find us on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and now also on TikTok. We had no engineers today. There were no phones, but a big thank you to Taylor Velasquez, who produced the show this week and joined us on the air. Thanks, Taylor. I'm Kaveh Movahed for Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM.